Hi there, I'm Tom Schultz, host of Voices of Montana, an issue-oriented newsmaker radio program heard weekdays on 18 radio stations with 27 signals all across the Treasure State. Thanks for clicking on the podcast. Please subscribe and we'll do our best to keep you connected. We're also on Facebook at Voices of Montana and on the internet at voicesofmontana.com, where I'd love to hear from you. Contact me at tom@voicesofmontana.com. Really hard to talk about this because we have to go back to this Hamas attack on Israel in early October. You remember that? And since then, we've learned an awful lot about the brutality, the biblical brutality, in my mind, I've called it, of that attack. There's been a response, obviously, from the Israeli government, both decisive, destructive as well. Where are we at now in the Middle East? Are we gonna find a path to some normalcy there? And of course, there's a reason for that, because as a hotbed, that could spread to other areas. Has that happened? And this agreement that it was brokered by the U.S. primarily, what's in it? We're going to talk today more and get right into the heart of this. University of Montana history professor Miradad Kia is the director of the UM Central and Southeast Asian Studies, one of the region's leading voices on the Middle East, and joins us today on Voices of Montana. You know, I'm looking around. We got a window in our studio here, and I see our life passing by, so to speak. Cars, traffic, people, you know, on their way to work or on their way to improve relationships or destroy relationships, whatever it may be. We don't have the same sense, and we haven't really in this country, that they live under in the Middle East. And it's hard, I think, for us to put a real finger on that. But that plays into our discussion today in a great way, because the history of conflict between Israel and Arab neighbors in the Middle East, pretty well known, at least at some point. There's a lot of things, I think, unknown about it. And then that's why we're lucky to have folks like University of Montana Professor Miradad Kia here, as I mentioned, one of the leading voices on Middle Eastern and Asian policies as well, and joining us here today to kind of look back and get a fresh look at where we've been, so to speak, and where we're going. And Professor Kia, I appreciate you so much for being on the program. How have you been?
Thank you very much, Tom, and it's a true pleasure to be back with you and your wonderful listeners, and I look forward to our conversation.
I kind of want to start sort of at the end a little bit, you know, about where we're at. I know they've talked about three phases of this war, the ground engagement, and then the second phase to dismantle Hamas's infrastructure ability. And then, you know, the third phase is getting a running government going there too. And that's a tough one. But you had said early on in this that the reason Hamas had attacked Israel and so brutally, in my mind, was they wanted to derail peace negotiations that had actually progressed under the former president, President Trump, and Saudi Arabia, one of the biggest Arab nations and leaders, engaging Israel. Was that successful? Are those talks and negotiations now down the drain?
You are actually hitting the nail on the head. The entire operation, the attack on October 7th, 2023, carried out by Hamas, it was actually financed and organized by Iran, by the Islamic regime in Iran. I always speak about two Irans, the Iran of the overwhelming majority of Iranians who despise this regime and have repeatedly called for its overthrow, and the regime, the government in Tehran, which is really one of the most dangerous threats to the global security of all of us, including the people of the region. This regime has created three very important proxies. One is Hamas in Gaza Strip. The other one is Hezbollah. We will hear more about Hezbollah because the war between Hezbollah and Israel is now intensifying in southern Lebanon. Yeah. And then there is this group, the Houthis, in Yemen, who have been attacking international shipping in the Red Sea. These are all financed, armed, and to some degree even organized by the Iranian government. And this attack was planned as a way to disrupt as you mentioned correctly, the Abraham Accords, which had been initiated by the Trump administration and had started the process of creating a permanent peace between Arab countries and Israel. In fact, several Arab countries had signed the Accords, which basically meant that the historical hostility between Israel and its Arab neighbors, and even the Arab world in general, will cease to exist. So countries like Bahrain, like United Arab Emirates, Morocco, Sudan, signed this peace treaty, and we were moving in a direction that the most important Arab country today, Saudi Arabia, was about to sign. In fact, the week that the attack took place, at the end of that week, Israeli officials were to be in Saudi Arabia to initiate the arrangement for the signing. That attack disrupted the peace process, and that was the purpose. Now, interestingly enough, the Biden administration downplayed the role of Iran, and it basically claimed that there was no suggestion that Iran was directly, in this word underlined, directly involved. And I think from the first get-go, the White House was basically trying not only to downplay, but to also ignore it as a way of containing the conflict. And the election year was coming in our country, and they wanted to basically ignore the role of the Islamic regime. And by the way, they were also negotiating secretly a new nuclear deal, the same deal that President Obama had signed, President Trump had discarded, and they wanted to revive. Now, as the operations go on, now we realize something very interesting, going back directly to your excellent question, that, you know, every war that Israel has been involved with Arab neighbors has taken place for a few days.
Yeah.
June 1967, October 1973, and so on and so forth. This war has taken months, which tells you how much Hamas has been building up its military capability. And it has taken months for Israel. Finally, it forced Israel to go to Rafah, in southern part of Gaza, to dismantle Hamas. It is coming close to its conclusion, but Hamas still maintains some military capability. And what is amazing is that while Israel is fighting for its survival, its principal ally, the United States, in the form of the Biden administration, has been pressuring Israel to stop its operations. What they are worried in the White House is that there might be a close election. They will need every single vote, including the Arab American vote in this country, especially in certain states like Michigan, New Jersey, California, and so on and so forth. And for that reason, they need to appease this community.
Well, if you had noted as well, and the last time we talked was shortly after the attack there too. You had noted the appeasement policy, and it's a policy that I think has, you know, definition to it, so to speak. You noted that it has never worked there. But then later on in a later writing, you said the Biden administration had awakened to that fact. Is that true?
They have awakened. I mean, I think all along they knew that as in the past, we have tried this several times, negotiating secretly,
yeah,
providing them with intelligence, and even at one point in their war, I'm sure many of our listeners remember that in 1980s, when Saddam Hussein had invaded Iran, we even went as far as providing Iran with spare parts and military support secretly. All of this have been tried, and none of them have worked. The Islamic regime in Iran refuses to become a normal regime, behaving like a normal government. And unfortunately, and I say this unfortunately, every time you use limited force it actually gives positive results. During the Trump administration, they were wreaking havoc in Iraq. They were trying to actually burn down the U.S. embassy in Baghdad. What did President Trump do? President Trump ordered an attack on Qasem Soleimani, the commander of the Quds forces. The Quds forces are the Quds in that context means Jerusalem. They are still hoping and dreaming of someday walking into Jerusalem and destroy the state of Israel. But this is the unit within Iran's Revolutionary Guards, which is the most elite unit. And Soleimani was the commander of that unit. And President Trump basically ordered a drone attack, and he was killed in that drone attack. Remember, when that took place and Soleimani was killed, we didn't hear anything from Iran for nearly a year, which tells you something. When the United States actually acts with assertion and with power, they notice it. And they go silent. When we appease them, they become brazen. Now, I've said this repeatedly in my interviews. I'm not calling for U.S. military intervention in Iran. It is not only not wise, but it's also very problematic, and it's going to be very challenging. Iran is a very geographically very mountainous country, 85 million people, big cities. I mean, the logistical sort of challenges, plus the fact that we have a huge ally in the Iranian people. We don't want to lose them either. We, in fact, have to help them and the opposition to the regime. But having said all that, I think the policy of appeasement and negotiating with them behind closed doors have not resulted into any positive results.
And in noting that as well, and again, Professor Miradad Kia is with us, professor of history and director of the University of Montana Central and Southwest Asian Studies Center. A lot of writings has focused an awful lot, of course, Middle East and Central Asia, the Ottoman Empire as well. And one of the University of Montana's favorite teachers as well, Distinguished Teacher of the Year in 97, Most Inspirational in 99, and National Honors from the Carnegie Foundation, too, in 2000. So thanks again for all of that. I've got a question about, you know, how for later on about how do we teach in today's atmosphere? Because, you know, the universities, I think, have been a pawn in some of these policies in some way. But I want to go back to, again, this appeasement. And when you noted President Joe Biden released oil, lifted sanctions, but then had come back and said, well, the Houthis are a terrorist organization. Again, in that context, you know, how do we expect the Middle East to respond to, you know, these sorts of policies coming from the United States?
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head. I as this administration came, they basically decided it's a very interesting approach. Whatever the previous administration, the Trump administration, had done, let's do the exact reverse, 180 degrees around. So what did we do? We had sanctions on Iran selling its oil. And you know, when they didn't sell it, their oil, they didn't have the money to arm and finance their proxies, like Hamas, Hezbollah, the Houthis, and so on and so forth. So we allowed them to sell oil. Guess who they sold it to, by the way? China. They made somewhere now, we believe, around 80 to 90 billion, would be $1 billion, right? The question is, where did that money go? That money went to the proxies. That money went to buying arms for the proxies. That money went to Gaza Strip to help Hamas, went to Hezbollah, the Party of God, in southern Lebanon, and the Houthis. We also did something very strange, which I mentioned it in a recent article. We actually removed the label terrorist from the Houthis, and we allowed them to operate as a legitimate organization. Of course, we have now rushed back to reimpose that label with the Biden administration coming under criticism for actually allowing the Houthis to operate as if they were a normal political organization. But all that empowered the Islamic regime. It worried. It created a great deal of anxiety among our allies, among them, of course, Israel, but also the Arab countries, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Kuwait, Bahrain, United Arab Emirates, Oman, Qatar. All these countries basically expressed some concern in terms of why are you rewarding Iran, and what have they done to be rewarded? They have created more havoc. Yeah. The other thing that is very interesting is that, of course, with $90 billion worth of oil revenue, they went shopping to Putin's Russia and Xi Jinping's China, which actually, so this money actually goes right into the Russian economy and Chinese economy because they sold billions of dollars of armaments to the Islamic regime in Iran. You know, when you actually look at this policy for the last 3 years, you only can scratch your head and say, you know, what was the purpose of this policy?
Yeah.
And what did it achieve? It achieved one thing. It made the Islamic regime brazen. It made the terrorist organizations it supports more brazen in terms of attacking Israel. And now we have to go in and try to somehow calm the waters. And, you know, still, you know, what is amazing, I have to give this example. You know, we finally decide something needs to be done about the Houthis in Yemen because they have disrupted international shipping in the Red Sea. And we are about to attack. We gave a 1 week advance notice to the Islamic regime in Iran. We know you have ships there. We know you have installations. We know you have officers stationed in Yemen helping the Houthis. We are coming. Please remove your target, you know, your ships, your boats, and so on and so on. We gave a 1 week warning, advanced warning. What kind of attack against Houthis is it that the Iranians know way in advance that we are coming? If you have any effective, you want to have any effective attack on their installations, you have to surprise them. So this is a policy which does not have any teeth, which does not have any real objectives, which has in fact created far more chaos in the region. And our allies, I have to tell you, I read as many newspapers, both from Israel and the Arab world, they are also scratching their heads. They have no understanding of what the ultimate purpose is. Is it all to appease Iran so we can contain its nuclear program? Well, that has not been achieved. They have continued to develop their nukes, their nuclear program. They haven't weaponized it yet, thank God, but they are getting there very quickly. And that's why I think it has created more confusion and more question about what the ultimate purpose of all this is.
A lot of scratching heads about that as well. What is next, obviously, is a question. The Israeli government has sent a pretty decisive but also very destructive message, and they are in a bit of a pickle with pressure now from other administrations to put an end to the conflict right now. Well, Israel is saying our goals are not met at all. Professor Mirdakia, University of Montana, is with us here, Montana Central and Southeast and Asian Studies Director. Thank you again, Mirdad, for coming on. I appreciate that. Just want to kind of go, you know, right into that. We do have China and we have Russia now playing into this as well. The brutality of this attack, how did that weigh? What kind of message? Because in my mind, it goes back to really ancient times. And this history goes back. You know, it's biblical. And this was very much a biblically brutal attack.
Yeah, I mean, in biblical terms, you read about the Assyrians and Babylonian empires attacking Jerusalem, sacking the Jewish city and destroying the ancient temple and taking tens of thousands of Jews into captivity in Babylon, mm-hmm. in what is today southern Iraq. The nature of the attack on October 7th and the savagery of it, kidnapping, raping, decapitating, and then killing so many of the kidnapped Israelis, reminds you of this this brutality, which is just has no sense of mercy or compassion for fellow human beings. And you know, the Israeli government, people always say, you know, why such a such an assertive and to according to some such a sort of all-out attack against Hamas in Gaza, simply because of this. And people always focus on Benjamin Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Israel. I ask you, you know, in a comparative sense, what did we expect from our president when the American homeland was attacked in September 2001? Mm-hmm. Could an American leader just sit back and say, well, you know, we need to somehow negotiate with bin Laden and Al-Qaeda, though they have attacked New York City, Washington, and they have brought down a plane in Pennsylvania, killing thousands of people. There was no other possibility for Prime Minister Netanyahu to really continue being the Prime Minister of Israel without really responding. And the response by overwhelming demand from the people of Israel was that Hamas cannot exist, should be eradicated. Now, I think Israeli military officials know this very well, that you cannot destroy Hamas completely.
They have said that. They have said that publicly, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. They have said it too. But you can at least weaken its military capability to the point that you will prevent it from waging a similar attack in the future. Whatever the case may be, I think it reminds us also that the big issue is really what to do with Gaza and what to do with several million Palestinians. I think eventually the Israelis, many, and there are many among Palestinians, they believe in some form of negotiated settlement. But as long as Hamas will act as the representative of the Palestinian people, Israel cannot negotiate. This is the problem. You negotiate with people who want to live next to you in peace. You do not want to negotiate with an organization which wants your destruction and is backed by your mortal enemy in Tehran, the Islamic regime, which has called repeatedly for the destruction of Israel and has openly denied the existence of Holocaust. These are facts that, and you know, on their ballistic missiles, the Iranian regime has written in Hebrew, "Let us destroy the state of Israel." Now, how can you negotiate with people who don't want you to live on Earth? And this is the problem. So you can pressure Prime Minister Netanyahu, but in the end, he's also a political leader who has to respond to the demand from his own people.
Professor Mirdad Kia is with us here, again, director of University of Montana's Central and Southwest Asian Studies. As I noted, real popular professor nationally as well, and one of the region's known voices on the Middle East and Central Asia. And Mirdad, again, I very much appreciate the time here. So much to talk about, and I'm honestly, sir, when I'm listening to you, I lose track of time. So, you know, I don't know if we're going to catch up on all the things that are important about this, because it is important to us. Let's go into this agreement. I presume that you've looked at it, this agreement, this peace agreement that's on the table that the Biden administration is packing pressuring, I think, Netanyahu to get into. Netanyahu does not have his objectives completed yet. So he's in a bit of a difficult position, isn't he?
Yes, and I think the peace agreement does have elements that will help the beginning of an end to hostilities. However, we have to appreciate this in order to understand the hesitation on the part of Prime Minister Netanyahu. If Israel comes out of this not as the victorious party and Hamas surviving in a very significant fashion, that would actually give Hamas the kind of popularity and legitimacy that none of us want to see, especially even the Arab countries, which are the neighbors of Israel. Remember, please, that it's not just Israel that is worried about Hamas. Egypt is, Jordan is, Lebanon is, Saudi Arabia is, the Persian Gulf states are. Why? Because Hamas is a very dangerous organization which threatens the existence of Israel, but also the political stability of the Arab countries in the region. If it survives, it can wreak havoc inside those countries. Let us remember, Hamas is actually an offshoot of Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. And what happened in Egypt several years ago, the Egyptian military had to take over and suppress Muslim Brotherhood,
yes,
which was supporting Hamas in Gaza Strip. All these layers are connected in some ways. So while they have been criticizing Israel, deep down the Arab governments actually appreciate Israel weakening the military capabilities of Hamas. Whatever the case may be, I think that the issue is now that Gaza is a mess, basically. The place, 25-mile strip on the Mediterranean with not much economy, with several million people living there, but also majority unemployed, majority suffering from all kind of displacement. And under the brutal regime of Hamas since 2005, 2006, there has to be a solution for Gaza. There has to be a build-up of Gaza. And Israel itself knows one fact. It does not want to stay in occupation of Gaza,
yeah,
and try to rule, you know, over 2 million Palestinians. And this is the issue. Who's going to run Gaza? And with what kind of money, with what kind of authority, with what kind of army? And it's in this context that the role of the United States is very important, to create a framework through which Gaza can be rebuilt, people can return to their homes, Israel can withdraw slowly, but with one condition, which Prime Minister Netanyahu has emphasized over and over, not allowing Hamas to rebuild its military capabilities.
And some of those countries in that area want the Palestinian Authority, back in power there.
Yes.
But as you've noted, those other Arab governments recognizing Jewish authority as a state was very much a very big move. So they have got a part to play in the peace, as you're talking about, and they're hesitant to do it. What would you like to see from them? What do Arab nations need to do to solve their half of this problem?
Right. Exactly correct. That is, they will be the main beneficiaries if Hamas is eradicated, and once peace is restored, that Hamas cannot reconstitute itself once again. This game cannot continue because it's going to cost many more lives if Hamas comes back. So they have a central role. Egypt does, Saudi Arabia does, Jordan, and other Arab countries, in making sure that they support this, not just nominally and formally, but actively. And they join Israel in terms of creating a security umbrella that would not allow Hamas to reconstitute itself. This is the key issue, and I think that as they say, the devil is in the detail. Is you cannot just say we want peace and we don't want Hamas. The question is what you're asking. What are you going to do to prevent Hamas? And you cannot just leave it all in the hands of Israel. You have to do enough to convince the Israelis that you are committed to the eradication of Hamas as Israel is. You know, there is another issue. There's going to be a lot of money needed to rebuild Gaza. And the Arab countries, not all of them, but some of them, have enough and sometimes far more than enough, like the Saudis, to actually contribute. And they can easily, financially especially, and in terms of construction, help the Palestinians rebuild their lives, rebuild their towns, and create an economy that would create jobs for Palestinians. Today, I think a large part of something that I don't think many of us realize is part of the attraction to Hamas. It pays well, and it recruits jobless, unemployed, frustrated, angry young Palestinians to its ranks by giving them a direction. But this is not the direction anybody wants the young Palestinians to go into. They need to be educated. They need to go to good schools. They need to find good jobs and so on and so forth. This is where the Arab world can do a lot of help by actually doing the right thing and helping Israel, basically rebuild Gaza. And create a real life for the Palestinians in the long run.
How close is Israel to accomplishing some of those goals, dismantling Hamas's military capability and then, getting it to a point where they're ready to consider some form of governance? I don't presume that this peace agreement has all those details. It does. But how close is Israel to accomplishing those goals to the point where they can say, I'm ready to, really ready now to move forward?
I think in principle, in general abstract principles, Israel and the neighboring Arab countries are all in agreement that Hamas has to be eradicated, cannot return. And as you mentioned correctly, instead Palestinian Authority, the so-called PA, which is based in the West Bank, should be brought to Gaza and given the role of running the Gaza Strip. The only problem there, as Israelis remind the Arab neighbors, is Palestinian Authority actually did run Gaza, and they lost to Hamas. This we cannot allow this to be repeated. They had Gaza, but they were incompetent. They were enormously corrupt. Palestinian Authority, sometimes, when you look at it, it's like a very bad mafia operation. You know, there are a lot of these kind of, very important characteristics who have their own turfs, and they make a lot of money out of these turfs. And the Palestinian Authority itself can be a helpful sort of factor, but in recent years, they have aged, they have become more corrupt, and they are not really operating in a sense that they have that they would convince the Palestinians to follow them. And that's why Hamas actually has become more powerful, because Hamas is more dynamic, more militant, spends more money, and so on and so forth. So by just saying we should bring Palestinian Authority and replace Hamas with Palestinian Authority, it's not going to resolve anything. We need to keep Palestinian Authority accountable. So if they receive billions of dollars for reconstruction of Gaza, that money will not end up in people's bank accounts in Switzerland. I mean, this is another issue, massive corruption among members of the Palestinian Authority.
Finishing up here with Professor Mehrdad Kia from the University of Montana, Director of the University of Montana Central and Southwest Asian Studies Center. And again, a very popular professor there, one of the region's leaders when it comes to Middle Eastern policy. You know, as a member of academia, Mehrdad, and again, thanks for being here. I think our university response or the academic response, it was maybe not a very proud moment for some universities out there. What do you make of all that?
Yeah, I was actually, I felt quite ashamed by the behavior of some folks among a lot of university faculty. The faculty is not there to become political partisans, but they're there to teach. They're teaching history as objectively as possible. Now, I know no one is completely objective. We all have our own subjective, personal, you know, conclusions. But when somebody at Columbia calls the savage attack on October 7th, 2023, as awesome, as sublime, as magnificent, that makes me shudder. That we have basically crossed the red line in this country, that we are no longer we no longer care about teaching facts and sharing information and education with our students, but to actually indoctrinate them, to brainwash them. And it was very troubling to see that. As far as protests are concerned, I'm all the way for complete freedom of speech and expression. However, that freedom of speech and expression should not allow anyone to prevent Jewish students to walk peacefully and carry out with their lives. I saw scenes of Jewish students being blocked from entering a certain building, certain classrooms. This is not some third world Middle Eastern country where people should be allowed to get away with this. All students, regardless of their opinion, their feelings, should be allowed to express themselves, but also to live in absolute comfort and security and express themselves freely. So these are signs of the return of a very ugly, one-sided, highly biased view of things, which should not be allowed to infect our academic system.
You know, I'm completely out of time, and I won't even, if I ask another question, I'll be way out of time. So thank you so much for being on. I appreciate that. We've got a presidential debate tonight. Do you have like 10 seconds on what you're looking for there or 15 seconds on that?
I am. All I'm looking for is basically to see a debate of issues rather than postures and attacks, basically, which, of course, I know I'm being too idealistic, but substance rather than images and claims.
All right, from your mouth to their ears. Thank you. Thank you, Mehrdad. I appreciate that.
Thank
Be well,
you very
sir.
Much, Tom, as always.
Yeah, have a great summer. Thanks again for joining us for the podcast. Please share and subscribe and let us know what you think. Email me at tom@voicesofmontana.com. And don't forget, we're on weekdays on your hometown radio stations all across Montana. We hope to hear from you there, too.